Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this bonus episode, it's a welcome return to friend of the podcast, Samira Ahmed. Hello.
Am I a bonus now? I'm not a real episode.
Well, you are a real episode, but it's usually about albums, isn't it? So I think it's like a treat.
That's true.
So we're here today to talk about...
Don't want to raise expectations of it being too treaty.
We're here today to talk about Paul McCartney, the lyrics. And normally we talk about albums, but we're talking about a book today. But more importantly, the book, which is 154 song lyrics from 1956 to the present, edited by poet Paul Muldoon and taken from a series of 24 interviews over a five-year period from 2015 to 2020. However, we're also here to talk about something that happened on Friday the 5th of November, which was an interview which took place at the Royal Festival Hall with both Pauls and chaired by you.
Yeah.
How was that?
Happy smile. It was great. It was just what you want it to be. You can all project what you'd like onto it. It was that. He was great. It was easygoing, very generous, and it was a huge amount of fun. And the audience, and of course you were there, Chris. A surprising number of people I know personally were there and got themselves tickets. Mm. It was an incredible atmosphere, very warm, very intelligent. There was like, at some of the dark audience questions.
There were.
And people messaged, I've been getting emails, as you know, I forwarded one to you. I've been getting emails from people who've been watching it on the recording. You know, you could watch it up to the end of the 12th, saying that they felt they could pick up on the atmosphere in the room from where they were, which is incredible.
Oh, so it was.
Feel very fortunate.
Well, sitting in the audience, it was tangible. The love, and there was a real thrill in the audience. Oddly enough, I had an email today from Felix White, who's been on the podcast before, ex-Maccabees, and he made a really interesting point. He was talking about the Isha demos. Because we all know the Beatles so well, we've grown up with them. Listening to the Isha demos was almost like flicking through an old family photo album. And his message he sent about seeing Paul at Royal Festival Hall, he said, it was really cool. Kind of like we said on the podcast, but it was almost like he was so familiar that there wasn't a sense of being starstruck or anything. Because Paul's been in our lives for so long, and I didn't feel it either. I thought I'd be fainting or swooning or anything, and it was like, ah, there he is. And I picked that up with so many people in the audience as well. Did you feel that?
I think it's fair to say I was a bit starstruck, but I think what was great about the setup was there's an element of it being like a deconstructed living room. There was kind of a big rug and some very comfy armchairs, which are known as the Michelle Obama chairs, because they were bought before her event. They're kind of big and purple and very comfy. And they just set that up so that everyone was comfortable. And, you know, there wasn't any elaborate sort of backdrop or anything. And so it was just a conversation. So I thought that was, and I think huge credit to Paul McCartney and Paul Muldoon in actually being very relaxed and open and generous, I think, with their answers and how they interacted. So I think to their credit, they made us all feel at home, didn't they?
They did, yeah. It was interesting to see the interaction between them as well. They're obviously very close.
Well, 5 years of conversations went into that.
Yeah.
And I think they are, I think there's a real bond there, so it was really valuable, actually. It was a very good call for Paul Muldoon to come and be part of it. And I watched the recording back twice, because I thought there'll be stuff that I regret. And the first time I watched it, I was a little bit... And then I watched it again yesterday, and I thought, you know what? I think that was all right.
I think it was great. Tell me about your approach, I mean, interviewing Paul, because the feedback has been so positive. Obviously, Twitter being Twitter, there are a few inevitable gripes, and it has to be said mainly by middle-aged men that obviously the solo years didn't get much coverage. But what was your approach?
As a specific thing? Well, that the approach was there was no point trying to do what the lyrics does literally, which is 154 stories based around songs. You know, I did come up with different ideas for the structuring, but actually... If you'd written a book with 154 stories in it, and you are, you know, how many of them would you remember verbatim? And how interesting would it be just to run through a list of that song and how did you write it? And so my approach was more, one, it was supposed to be a conversation involving the two of them. And second, it was sort of, it was the chance to try and get an insight into how Paul McCartney thinks about songwriting and sort of an insight into what formed him. So a lot of the questions, and I sent talking points in advance, but no, there was no, nothing was off limits. I wasn't, you know, asked to submit questions for pre-approval or anything. I came up with the idea of making it more influences and things that, I mean, I, you know, I've been, since August, I've been reading this book and I've been reading and listening to and watching a lot of interviews that he's done and all the other content that's out there and thinking, well, this needs to be something different. And also the crucial thing is you listen to what they're saying and where they seem to want to go and you follow them. And Paul Muldoon opened some really, very elegantly opened a couple of doors.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, beckoned to Paul. So it was Paul Muldoon who said, you know, perhaps it was an opportunity to think about how you know, you feel about John. I think it was a question about... And he raised that issue. And I think it's very significant that it came from him. So one of the things I've had in feedback from people who've enjoyed it, which I'm really pleased with, is the sense that I allowed the conversation to unfold as it seemed to be. It was his event, it wasn't mine. And I wasn't there to grandstand. But the stuff that I will say proudly I brought was the buses and the rhubarb.
Oh, yeah.
And anyone who knows, who's listened to any of the episodes I've done for your podcast will know the buses story is something I've pieced together just by listening to interviews. So Beatles on the BBC, yeah. His comment about them. They crop up in, there's an old, you know, McCartney on McCartney. There was a series on, I think, Radio 1 in the 90s. I was able to go back through the BBC archive with Luke Doran, who produced the Faces,
the stars
of Sergeant Pepper, who, of course, absolutely had to be there, like you had to be there. So I was listening to interviews he'd done. So I got the whole thing about the bus past Lewis's, although I didn't actually, that wasn't going to be my other question. I thought I don't need to ask a third question about buses. But I did ask Paul McCartney about it afterwards and he did agree. But the whole experience of living so much of his life on buses has been formative in how he thinks and him being an observer and having that thinking time. And of course, all the moments in his life that happened on a bus, whether it's auditioning or meeting. Did he meet George on a bus the first time?
Yeah.
Did they chat on the bus? You know, because obviously he would have been, you know, so much younger. So all these things. So I just thought it might be interesting to ask about them and see where he goes. And it turned out that there was a whole story. And the rhubarb thing, well, I thought was just a really interesting metaphor that George Harrison had come up with, that the Beatles were like forced rhubarb. But not as a negative thing necessarily. I mean, no. It was like the idea that the artifice of their life meant that they developed really fast. And to some extent, that's a question that was projecting forward into the songwriter he is. So a lot of my questions were actually aimed to be more general about, you know, they were about how he saw the world. And of course, I only chose two tracks because in the end, there's all kinds of issues about rights. So it's very practical. You know, you end up coming up with what can we do realistically, given all the constraints of the time, the audience and, you know, rights and copyright. And so I thought one Beatle track, one solo track, those are the two I suggested. They agreed.
Why did you pick those?
So I saw her standing there. If you read the book, he says, I think this is one of the best songs I've ever written. So straight away. But also it's a song from Please Please Me. And the idea of playing that in the Royal Festival Hall says everything about Paul McCartney's journey. And I knew it would be a powerful moment as an experience for the audience.
Oh, it was.
I think for him. And I think the setting was very important, you know, to be in. That's why I asked at the beginning about what it felt like to hear, and you know, what would the teenage Paul think of his song being played? Like, we're all sitting around discussing it. And then the second one I chose was because, in theory, it spun off in lots of different ways. So yes, the bus came up there, but it was also the idea that that's off a 2013 album, On My Way to Work, and so it was an opportunity to look at how he draws on memory all the time. And you know, I was listening to Memory Almost Full and Flaming Pie today, and what's that one that's got? Is it the Chaos and Creation and Chaos or Chaos and Creation?
Yeah,
I was listening to those three today, just on my commute. And, you know, there's a lot of songs there where you delve back into old memories. And so I just thought it spun off in that way too. And there was also the issue, which I didn't... I mean, there's one question I think I would have liked to have asked, and it was sort of on my list, but I just felt, I don't know, it never seemed the right moment, was he treats songwriting as his job. It's like a trade. And the whole sitting down and writing for 2 or 3 hours, whether it was with John or I imagine even since, and getting it done, like going off to the shed when he was writing McCartney 3.
Yeah.
I think people underestimate that a lot of great craftsmen, and I give the example of Ridley Scott, who's an 84-year-old film director who is still turning out amazing-looking films, and he storyboards everything, and it's a job to him, and it's a joy. And I think we sometimes underestimate the idea of great artists being craftsmen in the old-fashioned medieval guild sense. You know, they're banging away at things, and they just know how to turn out a good chair or a good song or a good film. And so that's the sense that comes across in the book very powerfully. So sorry I didn't ask that question. Maybe that would have taken us further forward. But I still think it's hard to see myself raising a specific question about Wings in the time that we had. But as I think I told you, I said I had an anxiety dream a couple of nights ago where I dreamt that I was being cross-examined in the House of Lords at a select committee about my interview with Paul McCartney and why I'd asked the questions I had and what I, you know, might have done differently. And
that's Twitter.
You know, but he, I think I'm allowed to say, he really enjoyed the interview.
Yes, yeah.
Everyone who was there, who was from, Paul McCartney's team, including his family, told me they really enjoyed the interview. So sorry if that's a bit of boasting, but
no,
you know, ultimately it was about a conversation that gave us all a chance to get an insight into Paul McCartney's mind. And I think we got that, didn't we?
100%. You were brilliant.
Oh, thank you. With each of the two song extracts, which we played, they worked out that actually it's a long time to be sitting listening. So they said we could put images over them. And I selected a couple of the key images. And I saw her standing there. There is that photo. And it's not just John and Paul sitting in the parlour at Falkland Road. It's them writing, "I saw her standing there in the parlour at Falkland Road." That's the moment. And obviously the mirror image. And again, so I chose songs and I chose photographs that was talking points. So we could then spin out into, talk me through how you and John wrote together and the idea of the mirror image. I did have a question, which I didn't quite have time to ask, but it sort of hinted at it, which is being left-handed and Ringo being a left-handed drummer on a right-handed drum kit. Was there something rule-breaking anyway about the way you just approach songs? But to be fair, that would become a song more about the craft of, you know, turning the song into music rather than about the lyrics. So I didn't take it further. But all those, there's all kinds of areas we could have taken that. And then the photograph of his passport photo on Way to Work. And obviously the song, the picture of him on the tube, you know, it's like him on modes of public transport, which, as you know, from I think the Hard Day's Night podcast episode I did, is a theme in their work. They're just talking points about the passport photo is an obvious invitation to talk about travel and dreaming and, you know, aspiration. Yeah.
But you said Mary spoke to you.
So, yeah, well, I met both Mary and Stella. And the thing about Mary, which was nice for me, was I'm a huge admirer of her photography. And I was able to tell her that there's the photographs that she took that are on the artwork for McCartney 3. And there's a particular photo of him on a horse dressed in black. And I first encountered it when he did an interview with the Sunday Times in December last year. I think it came out and it was, you know, ahead of the album release. And it was a great interview. But I just saw that photograph and it just stopped me in my tracks because it was quite solemn in a way. And yeah, I just thought there's something of Gawain and the Green Knight, of this kind of, you know, it's a very ancient concept in medieval literature of the kind of the folk hero who comes through adversity and it's a kind of force for the nation. And I just think there was something quite inspiring about seeing Paul McCartney in black on a horse in a time of plague, because I do think COVID is plague.
Yeah.
And the story that he told in that interview about how he went every day into the shed and was writing and then coming back into the farm and having dinner with the family. I think, you know, people have got through lockdown in different ways. And obviously there's been a huge amount of tragedy, but I thought there was something very moving and quite inspiring about the idea of, you know, artists who have found a way to create work that will engage us all. And haven't we all found the importance of listening to great music and watching good escapist films and reading books through lockdown? So I just said the photo was amazing. It was like Gawain and the Green Knight.
It felt that way as well when that album came out. Gosh, it had been a tough year and we were all locked down for Christmas. And then that album came out. It just made so many people so happy. It was just the perfect timing, I think. But one thing as well, when you were saying about the buses, which I really loved because it opened up so much. I mean, we're talking about the Transport Act. Is it 1947?
1947, yeah, which his grandson had written a thesis about. So I had submitted a list of topics, and one of the top, I mean, with a lot of them, I sort of gave a word and then I said, you know, because we could talk about this. But for that, I just wrote buses. I didn't give any explanation. I just thought, if he wants to talk, if he doesn't want to talk about buses, I will hear back. Yeah. And I heard back, no, they're fine. Anything on this is fine. And then before we went on, I just mentioned, you know, I don't know if I said I'm looking forward to talking to you about buses, but he mentioned his grandson's thesis then. But I don't know if he decided I don't think he necessarily thought he would mention it on stage, but he did. Mm. And I got to chat to his grandson as well, who'd written it. It's a great thesis. Basically, it's about how far public transport and buses might have played a role in the developing youth counterculture, which is actually a great idea.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, cheap and accessible public transport across cities and, you know, within cities meant that you could travel around and go off to meet people for gigs or travel across town to pick up a cord from somebody, which is, of course, one of Paul McCartney's kind of great stories. And all these stories, to be fair, they're all in the book. And, you know, one of the things which I think I talked about a lot is the photographs and the archival material fleshes out these stories, which is beautiful. And a lot of the stuff is from a long time ago. You know, it's images from the 50s and 60s, well, particularly from the 50s, that I think is formative to him. So the hitchhiking, where he said he'd realised, I used to instigate those trips.
Yes, you know? Yeah, which was pretty well went on throughout the career of the Beatles as well.
There's a great account in the book about the hitchhiking trip to Paris, where I think they'd meant to go much further. Were they going to go to Spain?
That's it, yeah.
But they never got further than Paris because they loved it so much. And that whole love of early 60s and late 50s Paris, you know, again, Jean-Paul Belmondo died only a few weeks ago. And I remember covering it on Front Row. I said, we've got to do an interview about this. And we interviewed Agnès Poirier, for a French journalist, just conveyed what those films represented in early 60s culture. They were so exciting. Mm. And, you know, in Britain, you know, there was this real fascination for the French Nouvelle Vague, and that all comes across in the way Paul McCartney sort of saw the world, I think.
Yeah. So you've been reading this book since August.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's been great. So, you know, one of the things that I sort of hinted at on stage when I asked about the decision to order it the way as A to Z is, it's so novel, because I had in preparation, I'd been listening to the Spotify playlist, I think, which they've put up for the songs already. And I was at the Waterloo by the National Film Theatre, probably seeing an arty French film. And I bought a copy of Band on the Run from the second-hand bookshop there, which also sells records. And so when the box arrived with the book, because it was very exciting unboxing the lyrics, I took it straight into my... I'd already dug out all my Paul McCartney records and albums and Beatles albums. And I thought, I'm going to put on Band on the Run, because I don't really know this album that well, although I know some of the great tracks on it. So you can put it on and then you start to look up, not every track from every album is on it, obviously, but a lot of Band on the Run are. And as each track came up, you would look it up and you'd straight away, it's like diving into something. It's like diving into a movie that's already underway, but it doesn't matter. Yeah. Because at some point, all the pieces will join up. And I think that's quite liberating. And I will just say, having recently been sent the Richard Carpenter biography of Carpenters, which I didn't know they were not the Carpenters, but Carpenters. It's similar look. It's like the same sort of size, it's one volume, and it's full of pictures and photos from early family days and tour dates and lots of physical objects that they've obviously got in an archive. But it doesn't have the liveliness of this, which has, it's in his voice because it's based on conversations. And Paul Muldoon did a lot of editing on it. So the stories about John that might have taken place in one or two conversations have been, you don't notice how, but you just know, because Paul Muldoon told me that they've been quietly, he says so in the introduction, he's quietly moved bits of conversation. So John and stories about John come up in different songs and track their friendship and their fallouts beautifully. And there's all kinds of, you know, reflections on all kinds of aspects of life.
So it was Paul Muldoon's idea to do the A to Z, because he said it would give it a sense of a great continuum, which it really does.
It seems easy now it's done to say, oh, yeah, well, of course you would. But it makes it just means you're diving into the story in a way that you're not used to, because some people are so used to seeing the, you know, 1962, the Cavern Club. And just it goes from black and white, then it goes into colour. And this way, I mean, as I say, I dived in with Band on the Run. And you can dive in anywhere you like. But I love the idea. You put on an album and you can look up the songs. And there's nothing to stop you reading them in alphabetical order, where, of course, you're jumping around in time. So I think it's also clever, which is very poetic thing maybe, to play with time.
Oh, definitely.
And to move backwards and forwards in time in his life.
Yeah.
You know.
And we're at a time now where, with the internet and so much information available, you know, most hardcore Beatles fans will probably know more than Paul about dates and chronology and so on. And by doing this, because he couldn't have done an autobiography, people would have picked it apart, and, you know, and I think this is a brilliant way of doing it, because it opens up new songs as well. You're reading about All My Loving, and then you might be on a song from new or lesser known solo albums. I think it's just the perfect way of doing it.
And the fact that it's visual, which, you know, one thing we established very well, and it's in the book, is this, you know, as I say, I don't know if he really has synesthesia, but there is a sense where he talks about seeing days of the week as colours, and that sense of overlapping senses, and obviously he's a painter as well. So it being a visual object really adds something. And I guess the comparison would be, if you think about a monograph, which is something that artists and poets often do, don't they? When they get to a certain point in their career, which is their work beautifully laid out in a book, bound book. And I love the idea that it's a bit of a play on the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, if you want to find Paul McCartney, look him up. Look up, you know, what's under Z or X or whatever. I'm not sure there is an X entry, actually. And it's got a proper index as well, so you can look up individual people.
Yes.
Or anything. You don't just have to use the A to Z. So it's been really carefully put together.
One of the highlights for me is, which you talked about at the Royal Festival Hall, the play that he discovered during all of this. Because you were saying about MPL as well, about the staff there, because you've got this treasure trove of artifacts that they've been going through. But you were saying how amazing they are.
Yeah, well, first of all, he says in the book that Linda was the one who sort of told him, you have to stop throwing away all your lyrics. But, you know, they used to just throw stuff away. So I do wonder with some of the very early songs, whether these are lyrics he just wrote them down by hand later. Partly, you know, someone's instigation. So, I don't know. But then there are loads of exercise books which he did keep, including school exercise books, which say words for songs. And there's one which says Beatles songs, which all have blue folders. I was quite interested in some of those objects. At one stage, I even asked what was the chances of having any of them on stage. And then I thought, of course they're not going to bring them out the archive. Stupid question, Samira. But it's also part, I did a programme called My Teenage Diary with Rufus Hound, and I brought in all my teenage diaries. But of course, that's because they have no value to anyone except me. And it was just, you know, to show them as a bit of a prop for the audience. But so first of all, Linda, I think, got him keeping them. And there's a couple of million objects now. But crucially, and Paul Muldoon said this very nicely and on stage at the end, there is an amazing team that works at MPL Communications. And I was fortunate to meet a few of them. Mm-hmm. And they are young and dynamic, and they are really, really thoughtful. One they're a delight to work with. But also, they take care of everything. And they know how to look after his archive. So there's all kinds of gems that they turned up. And yeah, he said he'd remembered that he'd written this play and they managed to find it. And there's, you know, if you look in the book, they've only printed, apparently there's four pages that survived, but there's two pages, a double spread. And it is quite funny. It's like a cliche of a kitchen sink drama where there's these people are talking in the kitchen at the sink about some daughter who's a bit slutty or something. They don't use that word, but you know, it's got that whole sense of, oh, she's a bit you know, a bit wild. It needs to be done in a kind of comedy, not comedy direction, but I don't know how, but I think you know more about it, I do. But it's lovely that it's just there. And so I think it's, do you know what the comparison is? The Bronte sisters' Juvenilia, which is now published, and my daughter actually studied some for A-level. Now everyone would say, of course, the Juvenilia is not the same as Jane Eyre or Wuthering Heights or The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. But of course you want to see it because it gives you an insight, and it's very important in understanding how the Brontes developed as writers. And of course they had a very different kind of life, incredibly sheltered, but with wild imaginations. So I think a lot of those artifacts, like the old school books and things, are, yeah, it's the Juvenilia of Paul McCartney.
Because we've known about this play since 1997, because Barry Miles mentioned it in Many Years From Now. And he said about the play, we were going to have this character, the person upstairs who never comes in, and the play is just people talking about him and his terrible crisis. Another quote from Paul, Al Pilchard, he's taken a turn, he's born again, and he really thinks he's the Messiah. He's upstairs praying. This was the way it was going to go, but we couldn't figure out how playwrights did it. So we've known this for ages. So to see it, and I think I mentioned before about why don't we do it in the roads with the monkeys getting down to business, to actually see those photos. We've known about this story forever. And I know it's a bit crass, but that was it happening. That was an idea coming into Paul's mind. I think it's amazing.
One of my favourite things in the book is there's a photograph of his school copy of Hamlet, which he studied for A-level, and the book at the beginning has a little, what do you call those things, the epigram? But it's from Hamlet, it's "To thine own self be true," which is, kind of great and appropriate. Mm. But he'd drawn a giant guitar on a blank page inside the copy and coloured it in really beautifully. It's all like night, looks like nice shiny wood, and underneath he'd written "happy guitaring." And it's great because, you just recognise the schoolboy who would do that, who has a passion for something. Mm-hmm. If he had a passion for football, he might have been doodling them. And "happy guitaring" is so lovely. So I really enjoyed those kinds of things and his great visual ideas for things like Sergeant Pepper, where he sketches them and the whole concept behind. I mean, I wrote a blog post about this, if anyone wants to read it, when I made the stars of Sergeant Pepper about, all the faces on the album cover and the concept. Paul McCartney had big theatrical, they're very theatrical concepts. So the idea of these northern boys going back home to the city and being given the freedom of the city. So it's very self-aware. And of course, they couldn't do that. They didn't have enough flowers and the right kind of flowers and everything. Yeah. So it's turned into something else. And then just little things like, this is one thing I didn't expect to find so delightful. So I'm not someone who's particularly into fashion, but I do notice interesting clothes and costume. And there's photographs of his Sergeant Pepper costume, including the label on the waistband. So you can just see, you get some close up of the detail. And of course, all these great clothes. And I was looking today, I'd taken a couple of photos from the book on my phone, just of images that were interesting to me. And there's one of him and George and Ringo standing with the cardboard cutouts from the Yellow Submarine, probably at a press promotion for the film. And George Harrison's wearing a navy blue, sort of quite high cut suit with a yellow frilly shirt. And Paul is wearing, I think it's a pink suit with an orange shirt and a white tie. And there's just so many photographs of them. As I say, they're like 18th century Beau Brummels. And the speed with which they went from being, leather jacketed sort of rockabilly teens to, put into those Pierre Cardin suits to then just going out into the full possibilities of 60s fashion it's lovely. And I just love a well-cut suit. And then the other thing, which is really interesting if you go through the book, although it's not explicitly mentioned, there's a lot about how he goes, to a Scottish farm after the breakup of the Beatles and finds himself there by losing himself from, the city. And there's a particular photo, takes a whole page, and it's him wearing pinstripe trousers that are obviously got really muddy, and he's got his wellies on and he's holding a lamb. And there's something about, I've always noticed it when you can tell when people have, what used to be a suit for best or a suit for their previous life has now turned into their rough clothes for when they're painting the garage. Mm. The designer sweatshirt that's now paint splattered. Yeah. And I suspect Paul McCartney would have had lots of pinstripe suits, but who knows? But I just thought that was really interesting. When you look, it looks like it's like a discarded uniform from his old job.
Yes.
And it's now become something that he just wears on the farm.
Yeah.
I found things like that quite interesting. Yeah. There's a lot there that's not verbal, that's visual.
Oh, there's so much in there. I think the theme throughout the book, and I think a lot of it, as you said before, was due to Paul Muldoon's editing, where Paul's talking about so many songs after the split, so 70, right up to 2020, isn't it? But so many, he always goes back to talking about the Beatles.
Well, I think I imagine a lot of that is the editing to connect things backwards and forwards. But there are a lot of songs where, Pretty Boys, which was also made into one of the 10 episodes for the BBC's Inside the Songs, which I do recommend people listen to because it's a song where you get to hear the song and he does a really animated reading from the book to illustrate each one. Yeah. He's very good at his observational eye. It's like seeing that row of stationary bikes, that, the hire bicycles, and turning it into a song which actually has all kinds of different layers to it. And he's actually a song about those photographers. And he talks about Blow Up. And, you know, when Antonioni came to London to film Blow Up, I think anyone who would have been in the sort of scene would have kind of got the call to say, hey, do you want to come and hang out? Because they're filming this film about, and he wants to see, you know, people like us. Yeah, so the, you know, so that song has got a story which is literally about some bikes, but it's also about his memories of 60s male photographers. And then there's also a kind of whole rent boy possibility in terms of interpretation. But one of the things he said at the Royal Festival Hall, which I think, again, if you, you know, so I'm really thinking he did a really good interview. He put out a lot of stuff there for people to take away, which is, you know, once you've written a song, you let it go. And then people will make of it what they will, including the conspiracy theories. That's where the interview ended, if you remember. And, you know, people can do what they like with them. Yeah. But it's like, as I say, he's like a craftsman. He's made something. It's like a physical object. And it's out there, whether you buy the album or you go and see him in a concert. And how you interpret it and what it means to you is up to you.
Mm.
But he's let it go.
Yeah.
And I felt that's quite liberating.
Yeah, which is great for me. That's what I've been doing for the last 3 years. Again, going back to your talk as well, still a very sensitive area, Paul, when he talks about John. You do it so well. You leave space for him to open up. And when he was talking about, you know, we were 16, 17-year-old kids and you could never say that you could love your mate, just wasn't done. So I never did. I never really just said, John, love you, man. And, you know, so now it's just great to realise how much I love this man. And that was so good to, well, it got a round of applause, didn't it?
I think it took everyone by surprise. It was great. You know, that was the thing. It was his event, it was his moment, and you just want to see where people want to go and help them where appropriate get there. But he didn't need my help. I mean, that, he obviously felt comfortable saying that. I do think, as I say, Paul Muldoon being there made every difference.
Yeah.
And I thought, so my job is, how do I describe it? I tell you what it wasn't. So you could go and watch that wonderful, and I think it is called 1, 2, 3.
3, 2, 1.
On Disney Plus, where he goes through the kind of musical construction of the songs with that great guy, and they do, you know, use the faders to single out individual instruments and so on. So that's been done, and you can do that catching up on those. And each film is a great little 30 minutes. Similarly, you know, you could go and listen to the podcast episodes where he's doing readings from each song. There have been interviews before about, I mean, there's a whole documentary about Band on the Run. There's a whole hour of Paul McCartney talking Band on the Run that you can find probably on the BBC iPlayer. So this was the Royal Festival Hall, which, you know, had been opened in 1951. It's the People's Palace. And he's on stage talking about the lyrics. And there's not a piano on stage and there's not a guitar on stage. It's a conversation. And it was great to be there.
It was. Another thing about him saying that about John, as fans, we all kind of knew that. We all knew that. And it's almost like the only person who didn't know that was John, because he felt like he had to say it, I think.
I mean, I've spent time reading the whole book. So the book has about his whole life, including all the stuff that happened after 1970. And I suppose in the end, you know, you just think, what the evening was ever going to be was, you don't need to buy the book because we've done it for you in 90 minutes. That was never going to happen.
No.
So
not in an hour and a half.
The joy is, you know, yes, we ended up talking a lot about the earlier years, but actually the joy is to get the book and then read so much more and see how it all connects up. And, you know, it's like watching, you know, Carlos Acosta is a great dancer, or watching Meryl Streep just deliver a brilliant performance. I've interviewed Meryl Streep and we've had the most, and she was a bit like Paul McCartney, really down to earth, incredibly easy to talk to, and gave such great stories. But, you know, it's no substitute for going and seeing her work or reading the book. So, yeah, I mean, the ones, you know, because Hamlet was my A-level text too. Part of it was just like, who knew that one day I'd be discussing my A-level text, I did Hamlet and Chaucer, with Paul McCartney. And one of the things that I, in my head, and I just thought, no, I'll never be able to do this, but it's interesting for me, is because I really know Hamlet, and it is a character that teenagers identify with, and he's put the quote from it at the beginning of the book. He's the opposite of Hamlet. Hamlet is, they're both dreamers, but Hamlet is a dreamer who can't bring himself to do stuff. So Billy Lyre is, in a weird way, closer to Hamlet. And Paul McCartney is the guy who gets on the train to London. He, you know, if you were the Billy Lyre character, and he's, there's this song which has a great chapter in the book called Do It Now, which is exactly what Hamlet keeps telling himself but never does, which of course is an adage from his father. And this sense that, you know, you go out and you grab opportunities and you do them. So whether it's, you know, shoveling up horse manure to put on the flower beds for your dad, he and his brother had to do, or getting him to audition for the choir at Anglican Cathedral, which he talked about on stage. And his father knew that you'd get free school books if you did it, which obviously Paul didn't care about the free school books, but his dad did. And he talks a lot about his mother, you know, very much encouraging him to, you know, excel and to do well and to get on in life. So, you know, the Hamlet comparison, I find, as I say, it's just an observation. It's not something, I mean, what, you know, if he said to Paul McCartney, oh, you know, you're like Hamlet, except you do it. And he would have said, yes. Yeah. But what would be, that's me making a point. That's not him being asked to offer any insight into his life. So, you know, the questions I asked were questions aimed at him telling us about what it's like to be Paul McCartney. And yeah, I thought it was, I say it again, I think it was a really generous conversation he gave us.
It was lovely. And it was a conversation. It was a chat. And it was brilliant. It was like you say, it was like being in a huge living room. And we were blessed to just overhear the conversation. And it was fantastic. It was so warm. And you both of them opened up so well. I think you did so well. I think it's brilliant.
Well, Paul Muldoon was great. And there was, you might remember, there was a moment where I think he might have been talking about buses. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to ask next. I've just lost my sense of where I am. And it was just, I was just having a great time. And if you were chatting with someone that you're having a good time with, you know, you might not think of your next question because you're just having, you're genuinely just enjoying what they're saying. And Paul Muldoon just graciously stepped in there and came up with another talking point. So
that was lovely. And that was so tangible.
Yeah.
Because you were, and you were like, oh yeah, oh shit, I need to ask a question. And we were all lost in that conversation.
I think there was a moment where you just thought, yeah, I'm kind of like the audience. I'm just thinking, this is just fun.
It was lovely. So I've asked some Eggpod listeners to send in some questions. So hopefully you can answer some of these. We've got first one from Eleanor Gray. And she said, Paul told you about the dream where he's in Wavertree and he can't reach a house in the distance. He's asking people how to get there. I thought this was significant, particularly if it's a recurring dream. Being psychoanalytically inclined, can I ask what you thought this dream meant?
No, I don't go there. Because the whole thing is, I interviewed, who's that writer who wrote, is it D.B.C. Pierre? And I interviewed him once and he said, you know, the thing about dreams are, it's where we speak the language of metaphor. So it's a metaphor for something. But who hasn't had dreams about reaching out or trying to get somewhere? I'm always having anxiety dreams about worrying about missing a train or a flight to San Francisco. So I don't think we need to overinterpret, but I think it was just great to have this sense of he does. I think there was a whole conversation about songs that come from dreams.
Caitlin asks, did the talk seem to go very fast for you? I went to check my watch thinking 20 minutes had gone by and was a little mortified to realise it had been an hour.
I'm really glad to hear that. I mean, yeah, it went by well. I did know how much time was going by, though, because we did a sound check, which was so much fun. And because of the way that my chair was at an angle and I had a table in front of me and it was hollow. So and I said, actually, could I have some way of timekeeping? Yeah. And they said, we've got a clock. So they put a little digital clock down there for me, which made, again, it just made the evening elegant and effortless for me. So instead of me looking at my watch or taking my watch off and having to put it in front of me, I could just keep an eye on that and see how things were going. So I did know where we were in time, but I certainly don't think there was a wasted minute.
No, it did absolutely fly by. Paul Abbott from the Big Beatles Sort Out podcast says, we spotted you trying to get a nerdy question in about Dr. Beeching being tapped up to sort out Apple. Did you have a bunch of deep dive questions you really wanted to ask?
No, he's so good. He spotted that with Busted. Yeah. Paul Muldoon stopped me going down that particular furrow or train track to the buffers. I don't know. I probably was getting a bit nerdy at that point, so I was probably just as well. No, there was just things like that. When having the thing with my approach to this, which I did last time, I've done something I suppose on this scale was when I interviewed John Waters, who is another huge hero of mine. And I saw every film of his, and I read every book he'd written, and I watched all the talks he'd done, which are available on DVD. And it's sort of like it's absorbing everything. So you've soaked it up, which means if someone brings up a reference, you can just go there. And I joke with people that I'd listen to all Paul McCartney's songs, especially the 150 were in the book, so often, because it's been my playlist since August, that there was a show called Name That Tune with Tom O'Connor, used to be on ITV. Yes. I'll name that tune in one. that's the level I got to. And I kind of felt with some extent with anecdotes or stories or mentions, I was like, I'm on it. So I don't think the world missed a great question there about Dr. Beeching.
Right, a couple of questions here that kind of on the same lines. Mark Crilly and David Rogers. Mark asks, are there any Beatles songs you used to love that you don't like so much anymore, or songs that you didn't like before but now enjoy? And David, again, from the lyrics book, are there any songs that you initially wasn't a great fan of beforehand but have now come to appreciate more?
So I'll take the second question first. Having listened to... I actually started listening to all the solo stuff first, much more than the Beatles stuff. I already knew the Beatles stuff very well. Mm. And I dug out the albums that I already owned. I had bought McCartney 2 when it came out in 1980 with my pocket money, because that was the year after all the Beatles films were on TV. So it's like, Paul McCartney's got a solo album out. I can, you know, and he's still producing new music. This is very exciting. So I had that. I had bought Flowers in the Dirt. I had a very good, there's a thing called, I think it's called All the Best, which is a double LP of kind of a lot of his greatest hits from his solo years, including Wings. And then I'd bought Band on the Run. So those are the ones I had on vinyl. Plus I you know, downloaded all the albums on you know, streaming. And I just really came to appreciate the depth and range. And there's a time travel element to the solo work and the Wings work. So, you know, I remember the 70s very well. I remember Mullet McIntyre being number one, flipping ages. And it's been a long time since I heard it. I remember at the time people moaning. And I remember thinking, it is a good song, but it's been number one for a really long time.
Yeah.
I heard it again. And you know what? It's a flipping amazing, you know, anthem. You know, it's like, again, it's like, you know, I think what people who don't like about it is it totally works.
Yeah.
You know, he's in the great story in the book about, you know, I was living in Scotland, I thought I would do this kind of a Scottish, I don't know if he said an anthem, but, you know, like something which feels Scottish. So he's this Irish boy from Liverpool who's written the kind of one of the most famous anthems of sort of modern Scotland. And there's a great photo of his children offering tea and drinks to all the band of bagpipers who turned up for the recording. It's just great fun. And then there's one song which he doesn't like, slightly twisting the question. I think Rock Show or Venus and Mars.
Yeah.
And in the book he says, I don't really like this song, but what's again fascinating about it, because I do quite like it, it's got a whole Steve Harley buzz to it. You know, there's the word kitty. You know, he's talking in kind of character voice. It's very Steve Harley kind of voice. And I just thought, even if he doesn't like it, he's done exactly that kind of Harley-esque song, just worked out how to do it and do it really well. And so I like Venus and Mars, but it's like a time capsule too of that period in the 70s, as I'm old enough to just about remember it as a kid.
Yeah.
And then the later solo albums are great, but they're all great. There's gems on everything. And... Oh, yeah. I do think, you know, there's some great tracks on Tug of War. Flowers in the Dirt was a great rediscovery for me because I'd forgotten the Elvis Costello connection. And when I was living in LA in 1996 to 1997, there was a film that Elvis Costello wrote the title tune for called Grace of My Heart, which was a fictionalised biopic of Carole King, of Goffin and King, who, as we know, Paul McCartney was sort of hugely inspired by and went to her being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, quite recently. And so there was a lovely sort of drawing connections for how, you know, Elvis Costello, of course, is just all these different ways that these musicians connect up with the great history of rock and roll. And that's why it was great to get in that question about the great influences. And then in terms of songs that I might not like anymore. I mean, I do like them all, but I will be honest, I have never cared for Why Don't We Do It on the Road.
Awesome.
Partly for, I'm just a bit,
It's a bit fruity, and so, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but you know, we're allowed to not like, I mean, some of those. The White Album I listened to a lot a couple of years ago because I was asked to do something for Apple where, you know, the Apple Lego set?
Oh, yes.
That was based on the White Album pictures. So I was listening to that album on repeat a lot a couple of years ago. In fact, it was during the start of the first lockdown, I remember, because I used to listen to it on my walk, my 1 hour walk. And I think that is the album where I think there are a couple of songs that I don't like so much. But overall, the impact of listening to so much and listening to the whole career arc has been, I'd say my love has grown bigger and deeper, and I love it all. And I don't think I would have said that automatically. I would have thought, oh, I'm not sure I like all the Wings stuff. I'm not sure. But I wouldn't have heard it all properly.
Yeah.
But, you know, Venus and Mars has got some amazing stuff. And, you know, I keep coming back to the visuals. You know, I just remember when the album came out and, you know, the two, the billiard or snooker balls, yes, aren't they, on a snooker table? Yeah. It's just such a simple idea. It's not connected to anything other than, oh, it's a clever metaphor for Venus and Mars. But it's unforgettable. Yeah. And I think what comes across, again, one of the other issues that comes across through the book is Paul McCartney's all-round showman and thinker. You know, the visual packaging of the music, the segueing. I was talking to a friend of mine, Graham Kibble-White, his brother.
Oh, yes.
Jack Kibble-White's playlist on Spotify, which is his personal favourite 300 Paul McCartney solo songs. And I got sent, that was the first piece of research I got sent. And of course, a lot of those songs aren't on the book because these are 300 tracks from his solo career. Mm. And funnily enough, one of my favourite solo songs wasn't on that list, which is Hope of Deliverance, which I really love, which is off the ground.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
But it just meant that there's a massive universe of Paul McCartney recordings out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hadn't actually got my head around all of it, but I possibly have now. If I ever get asked back on Mastermind, maybe it should be Paul McCartney, the solo years.
Yes, do it. Do it now, in fact.
Yep. Of the albums that, and I do like a lot of them, I think the albums that have jumped out at me that I didn't know this album and I absolutely love it, Memory Almost Full and the track House of Wax, because it's such an original idea. It's got a very gothic feel to it. I mean, there's a little bit of Ken Russell in it. I love that. So I think there's a lot of unexpected gems which work on their own terms. Yeah, and Flaming Pie is a great listen. I think Memory Almost Full, someone was saying to me they thought it had been undervalued at the time, and I think it has. I think it's great.
There's an Egg Pod episode with Ian Lee talking about that. I definitely suggest having a listen to that, because he, especially House of Wax, he just does it so much justice. You'll love it. Sorry about that.
No.
Advert. So the last question from Ian Kinsey, and he asks, considering you are never going to have enough time to cover everything, how did you decide what to ask?
Having come up with talking points, you know, I'd been making notes for a few weeks, and I looked back at them the other day, and, you know, I made sure I'd waited a while before I wrote down question ideas. I didn't just start writing questions. I was listening to the music, and I'd read the book a couple of times and had done a lot of interviews, and I thought, what are the stories that are emerging that I think are interesting to pursue? And so I basically came up with what I thought was a logical way to talk through a conversation with Paul McCartney, with the book as the starting point. What's the story here? And some of them, questions like buses, I'd pieced together from, you know, reading between the lines, the stuff that it seemed to be hiding in plain sight, that he really likes buses, and there's a really interesting story there about their role in his way of thinking and seeing the world, because he's an observer. So and the rhubarb quote, I had watched, again, one of the first pieces of research I did, I used my daughter's Disney Plus account, thank you very much. And she thought, what is all this stuff coming up on my account? Who's been watching this? I watched the Ron Howard documentary 8 days a week. Actually, no, I watched that on, that was on Amazon, so I had to buy it. And I made sure I watched it within 48 hours. I watched it twice. And the George Harrison quote about being like forced rhubarb, it's just in audio, you hear it over footage of them. Around, it's towards the end when they're talking about the making of Sgt. Pepper in the documentary. And I just thought that's such a great metaphor. And to be honest, it was supposed to be a question that opens up into, if you want, to talk about the fact that you're forced rhubarb, once forced rhubarb, always forced rhubarb. I mean, that's the thing. That's how he works. He just is always developing and taking on new influences. And, you know, nothing is ever the same. Everything is always different. And so some of those questions kind of came out of Gems of Places. And then the other one was Joe Wharton. I was quite fascinated by. I'd made a whole special programme about Joe Wharton, who seemed to be a rule breaker from a similar background, actually. You know, quite low working class. Obviously, incredibly breaking the rules, because he was, you know, pretty openly gay at a time when it was still a criminal offence. And obviously had died incredibly young. And I'd spent time with Joe Wharton's sister in Leicester. She's amazing, Leonie. And the influence of libraries and books on him. You know, he knew his Shakespeare, he knew his stuff. So there were some lovely similarities. And because there was the diary entry about Paul McCartney, I thought it's always fun to read someone else writing about you. And of course, it was a bit of a funny quote because considering Paul McCartney is very famous for going to the theatre lots, and that this is a quote with Paul McCartney supposedly saying the theatre is really boring. So, and I did ask ahead of the interview, you know, so I put on a talking point like Joe Wharton, I wonder if there's anything more, because there's a great mystery in that film. If you see Prick Up Your Ears, which is one of my favourite films with Gary Oldman and Alfred Molina, and there's a scene in that film by Stephen Frears where a chauffeur-driven limo stops outside the house and it's Paul McCartney supposedly sitting in the car to take Joe Wharton off for a chat. So I was just quite intrigued as, you know, can you give us the Paul McCartney side of that story, was sort of where that came from.
Yeah.
And certainly there's this foremost Joe Wharton scholar who's called Dr. Emma Parker, who's at Leicester University, who I know. I messaged her and I just checked the quote with her and I said, is this all in the public domain? She said she'd heard it, but I don't think he'd spoken about it particularly before. So it's a nice little bit of, you know, again, piecing together the avant-garde Paul with the world that he was part of, and that opened his horizons.
Absolutely. I think for me, it was lovely to see you in the news for something so positive, because you think it was only a couple of years ago you were in the news during that tribunal.
I know, it's funny, isn't it? It's almost exactly 2 years ago. So I felt like, definitely felt like good karma. And I was incredibly touched that they thought to ask me. That was amazing.
So glad they did. So overall, what did this... Let's, first of all, the book. What's the book mean to you? But then let's end with, what did this interview with Paul, the two Pauls, mean for you?
Well, the book was such a lovely delight. And, you know, thinking back to, I dug out the Beatles and Illustrated Record, you know, which I had read, I think it came out in 1978, by the two NME writers. And I remember the effect that book had on me going through it again, because every page you turned, you know, it had a section on, you know, the Beatlemania years and the psychedelic years. And in its own way, it was full of found objects like ticket stubs and amazing photographs and, you know, NME polls and things. So it brought back that feeling, but of course, much more so because this has been really, you can tell it's been really carefully thought through. And you obviously have the riches of Paul McCartney's life and career and songs from a starting point, plus the archive. But also the care that's gone into the transcription and the editing, it's a real delight. I think a lot of people are getting it for Christmas. And, you know, it is hours of pleasure, because it's a whole new way to approach your record collection. And because it's a conversational voice, it's very accessible. I mean, the one thing I'll say, it's funny enough, my friend Ben Milne, who's an old colleague of mine at the BBC, and he and I have known each other since we were students, and he gave me A Revolution in the Head for my birthday in 1996, just before I went off to LA. And I remember reading it when I was living in LA. And there's a lot about it that's great, but it's pretty serious and it's a bit hard going sometimes, isn't it? It's like a music scholar's book.
Mm.
And I just think The lyrics is the book that every Beatle fan wants without having to be super academic. Can I put it that way?
It's very inclusive, isn't it?
Yeah. And someone, in fact, someone I met from Penguin Random House, there was a dinner afterwards, and he said to me that, you know, something that Paul talked about on stage, but it's also in the book, this whole thing about everyone's got an Uncle Jack. You know, he talked about the uncle who tells you stories and then brings out a handful of half crowns and kind of gives you some money to go off and treat yourself. Everyone has a relative like that. And to some extent, that's part of the power of the book, is recognising the family that makes you is part of what makes us who we are. And obviously not everyone had a great family like he did. And that's a great part of the book where he talks honestly about, he knows he was lucky, he knows how John's setup and family experience are so different. But a lot of us can sort of draw some recognition, can't we, in that? And the sing-song around the piano and all that stuff.
There were so many photos of Auntie Jin, which was lovely to see.
Yeah, so actually, one of the great stories from the book, you know, I mean, I could talk for hours about stories in the book that are great, but there's a great one for Your Mother Should Know, which is about, sort of, partly about Auntie Jin being sent down when it was thought he was getting a bit out of order, and they were probably hearing rumours about what he was up to. And you know, his aunt would come down to stay for a few days, and just to sort of, you know, Paul, you know, you thinking about the implications of what you're doing. And that, great, this is Paul McCartney telling the story himself. And in the Barry Miles biography many years from now, Barry Miles talks about coming to Paul's house right into the late 60s. And he's got a load of his aunts around, or, you know, a couple of aunts and uncles are staying, and they're having sing songs around the piano.
Yes, it's amazing.
Oh, that's really lovely. Oh, that's great. Yeah, see, this is the thing, we come back to my point, which is rock stars. You know, we have this idea that, I don't know who's really responsible, maybe it's the Rolling Stones, but this idea that rock stars don't respect family, you know, they're too cool to hang out with their aunt, and they trash things, and they treat everybody badly, and they swear a lot in public. And I just think the Paul McCartney story is more fun, because it's not like there wasn't wild times. I think, you know, there's hints at all that in the book, but he's not ashamed of his family. I think that's something that a lot of us who came from, I think, you know, dare I say, I think a lot of people from immigrant families, maybe I've always felt this an affinity between the Irish and the Asian, and I think a lot of Caribbean families too. The sense that, you know, you never forget where you came from, and you're not ashamed of your family. I think not being ashamed of your family is a really powerful thing in this book. And too many rock stars and film stars, and it's kind of, you know, it's there's that great photograph, isn't there, of Donovan with his mum.
Oh yes, yeah.
And his parents in their living room, and he's not. I'm not saying he's ashamed of them, because he's photographed them, but you know that incongruity. Yeah. Whereas I just think all of the Beatles, there's lots of photos of all of them. That relationship between their past and their fame seemed much more porous. It went both ways.
Mm.
But if you take the example of, we've been talking about, you know, Your Mother Should Know, one of the other great stories in the book is, you know, there's lots of photographs of him and Jane Asher, and photographs of Linda, who obviously is a very big part of the book and their relationship. And I was having lunch with my friend Murray Melvin, who was one of the stars of A Taste of Honey, both the stage play and the film, was Richard Tushingham. And I told him, the way you do, I met Paul McCartney. And he said, of course, he'd met them all. And he can't quite remember when or where, but it was something through Rita, and he thinks it might even have been at the Royal Festival Hall or somewhere around it. And I wondered if it was, you know, a film premiere or something. But he said he sort of knew Paul McCartney a little bit in the 60s as a result. And one day he was walking down Abbey Road, because he lived near there, Murray, and he saw Paul McCartney near Abbey Road Studios with a guitar serenading Linda. This has been about 1969. He said, oh, you know, hello, Paul. And Paul, oh, hi, Murray. And Murray said that I just felt like, I said to them, don't stop. And I just wanted to leave them and move on. And he said, it was like seeing a medieval troubadour. That's who he was. And I said, you know, there's a story in the book where he talks about, it's the song I Will off the White Album. And I think the opening line of the article or the chapter about that song is, this is me as Alan Adale.
Yes.
So he's very self-aware that, you know, he gets that guitar and he you know, he can do that. And I just thought that was so sweet that literally I met someone who'd seen him and had a story about seeing, you know, the troubadour, Paul McCartney, serenading on the street. And then there's a whole chapter in the book about it. So all these things ring true. And I thought that was part of what was charming.
Yeah.
You know, he's quite playful about the different things. I mean, one of the other things I might have asked, but again, I wasn't sure there was a question. It was more like a statement. And I thought, I'm not here to make a statement, but I tried to count the number of different Paul McCartney voices there are. Oof. And there are literal voices, which we've discussed before, like this sort of the swoony Paul. There's the rock and roll screaming James Paul McCartney, kind of Little Richardy Paul. There's the more bluesy Paul, you know, there's something with Jerry Lee Lewis Paul. And there's a rock and roll kind of sort of 70s, like a Steve Harley voice. Yeah. And then there's the sort of retro crooner voice, like the Al Boley voice, where he does on Honey Pie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I was listening to Postcard, you know, the Mary Hopkin album, which of course he's spin off to, because that's the other thing, is he put songs that he wrote for other people in this. So he's, you know, and that's an important part of it. But he basically, you know, apparently just kind of wanted to almost reconstruct that Al Boley arrangement. So, you know, I think all these different voices are very interesting, but they're all reflected in the book beautifully.
Mm.
And of course, there's the more avant-garde Paul and everything. So, but what would have been the point of saying to him, I've come up with seven Pauls, here's a list of them. Yeah. It would be me showing off. So I didn't do that.
Brilliant. So the other part, what did you enjoy about the show itself?
What did I enjoy about it? Everything. You know, I think I did a good job. I prepared well. I think he said stuff he'd not discussed before, and he enjoyed it. And it was a statement. You know, this book is, to put a book out like this now, it was 5 years of conversations at this point in his life. You're putting your record of your life out there for other people. And I think that's a huge thing to have done. So gravitas is the wrong word because it's not a solemn thing, but it is a serious thing, isn't it? To make a statement like that about looking back over your career at this point in time. And unless he's planning a volume two, which I suspect he's not, this is the kind of big landmark book. It's, he says, I have kept a diary, but I have my songs. So I just wanted that occasion to feel appropriately marked with respect, but with a sense of fun, and crucially with a sense of inclusivity, because it's about all the audience. And being in a room with 3,000 people and then knowing the live stream, that was, I think, made it all the more special rather than just being in a studio doing it on our own. It was great.
It was. You're brilliant.
Thank you.
Can we mention about afterwards?
Yeah. So there was a dinner afterwards, which I was invited. It was really lovely. And at the end of it, I noticed there was a grand piano down the end of the room, but, you know, don't want to assume anything. And then suddenly the piano started up and he played Lady Madonna for everyone. And it was just like, it was as good as the record. And he said, I see a piano and I can't resist. So that was, you know, that was quite memorable, I think it's fair to say. So the whole evening was great. The whole evening was really memorable for all the good reasons.
Brilliant.
And I don't think it would have happened if it hadn't been for you, Chris. And me being on the podcast.
Samira Ahmed, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Hey!